Morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, Amy Brown from Squire Sanders for the appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This is a case of statutory interpretation under the Rural Service Improvement Act, or RSHA. When Congress enacted the RSHA in 2002, the Alaska bypass mail system was on the verge of collapse. Bush carriers were coming into the mainline markets, diverting the bypass mail from the existing mainline carriers and creating destabilization of these markets. So Congress reacted by enacting the RSHA and redefined the eligibility.
Otherwise, but Ted Stevens got him to protect the oligopoly, right?
Your Honor, it is not an oligopoly. What it is it's a highly regulated industry. Like any industry, Congress determines who can participate and under what circumstances the participants are able to carry the bypass mail. And here, like I said, there was destabilization of the mainline markets. So with the RSHA, Congress mandated that the Postal Service tender bypass mail in the mainline markets to the existing mainline carriers, except for in certain limited circumstances. And one of those exceptions is at issue here today, and it's frequently referred to as the no incumbent provision.
And say, counsel, our speaker system seems to be working extremely well, so.
Step back a little.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have a loud voice. But under this no incumbent.
I heard that in the reply brief.
Under this no incumbent provision, Congress set forth requirements that a carrier must satisfy to enter the market. And one of the requirements is that the carrier be a new carrier. And new is a defined term under the RSHA. There are three separate and independent requirements that a carrier must satisfy to be considered new. And the
Which
second
section are you referring to now?
It's section 5402A15. It's in the definition section, and you can find it in the addendum
at two.
Yes. And it's the second requirement B that is at issue here.
And everything depends on the interpretation of the phrase bypass mail service.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Non-priority bypass mail service. And the reason that Pennair does not qualify as a new entrant is because it did provide non-priority bypass mail service prior to January 1st, 2001.
And of course, the government takes the position that non-priority bypass mail service in that section B refers to mainline.
That's correct.
Or that they're two separate kinds, Bush and Mainline.
That's correct.
Your argument is those modifications are not in B, therefore it includes any kind of bypass mail service.
That's correct, and in fact those modifications appear in A, the first requirement under the definition of new. The requirements that a carrier must satisfy under that first requirement depend on whether the carrier is seeking to become a Bush or a mainline carrier. And so Congress made that differentiation in
A. You read B as if there was a word any, began providing any non-priority bypass mail service. You say that's the way it reads.
No, we're not reading anything into the language.
Well,
rather,
that's the meaning you want, that any non-priority bypass mail service, right?
Well, just non-priority bypass mail service generally.
It refers to any, right?
Well, it is any, but it's clear from the language that it's non-priority bypass mail service. There's no qualifier there.
I think one of the most interesting things about this case is everybody argues that the statutes are clear and unambiguous, and I must confess that I rarely have seen a statute that's so screwed up.
Your Honor, but I do think what is clear is that Congress said non-priority bypass mail service. It didn't say mainline.
It's absolutely out of the question that an irrational reading would include the reading began providing the appropriate, the relevant non-priority bypass mail service.
I do believe it's out of the question because if you look at the first requirement, when Congress wanted to differentiate what a carrier had to do, it knew how to do so. And in the second prong.
I'm sure it knew how to do so. Cliche, I loathe. But it still remains the possibility that they used another technique in the next clause.
Your Honor, if you look at the definition of existing mainline bypass, existing mainline carrier, which I believe is also at Addendum 2, there, Congress specifically identified non-priority mainline bypass mail. In that situation, Congress wanted to make clear that the carrier had to be qualified and had to have provided non-priority mainline bypass mail service. Whereas when Congress was defining new, it just referred to non-priority bypass mail service, didn't qualify it as it did in the existing mainline carrier definition. And the reason it didn't qualify and the purpose behind the RSHA was you had bush carriers coming into the mainline markets, and Congress wanted to maintain the status quo. It did not want the bush carriers coming in and destabilizing the markets. So it made
this. I have one small question, just a clarification. You're not serving the same locations that Penn Air is, are you?
My clients, yes. My clients provide non-mail freight service to these locations.
Yeah, but you're not doing bypass mail.
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
You're doing bypass mail, so it's direct competition?
We're existing mainline carriers, so yes, we're receiving a tender.
Okay.
Yes, so, and we're doing that under the provision where Congress said the bypass mail should go to the existing mainline carriers. This is a choice Congress made given the problem it was facing, and it made this choice. And the Postal Service and Penn Air may not agree with the choice, but it is a choice that Congress, a line they drew. And Congress knew how to differentiate the requirements if it wanted to, and it chose not to do so. So the answer isn't to rewrite the statute. If the answer is to go back to Congress if they don't agree with this policy decision. If I could now just move on to the other issues that are on appeal in this case, the no incumbent provision that Penn Air seeks the tender of bypass mail on also requires that a carrier satisfy the prior service and capacity requirement.
Before I had a little trouble understanding your argument.
You purport
to be relying on the plain language of the statute that requires that they have carried for 12 months before they were selected. I looked at the date of selection that I think you're challenging, and I got a date around, is it August of 2000?
What happened?
I looked back at the record, and it appeared that they had been carrying for more than 12 months prior to that.
Your Honor.
I sort of got lost. You claim
to
be relying on the plain words of the statute, and yet there seems to be compliance with the plain words of the statute.
I will try to clarify and explain why Penn Air has not complied with the requirement. Penn Air first began receiving the tender of mainline bypass mail.
Excuse me, counsel, before you do it, are we talking about 5402G5C?
That is the provision under which Penn Air seeks the tender of mainline bypass mail.
That's the section that says, notwithstanding subparagraph A, and then ends by requiring subparagraph A, and also requires subparagraph D, which doesn't exist.
Well, it existed when it was originally written, and then it was amended.
Never enacted.
Enacted, yes. But Your Honor, if you look at it, the notwithstanding subparagraph A refers to a whole separate provision and the requirements under a provision that's not relevant here. What the no incumbent provision that you just read does require is that a carrier satisfy the prior service and capacity requirement.
Which I'm not understanding how you can say they have not. You purport to be making a plain language argument.
Because when they.
You admit they've complied with the plain language of the statute.
No.
You don't?
No, Your Honor. We do not admit that.
What part did they not do? Did they carry for 12 months?
They did not carry for 12.
Did they carry for 12 months?
No, they did not.
Did they carry for 12 months? That's a yes or no question.
They operated for 12 months. That's correct.
They carried, right? As the statute?
They carried bypass mail while they were operating. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah, so the answer is yes, right?
Yes.
More than 12 months, right?
The answer is they operated and carried bypass mail.
More than 12 months, right?
Correct.
And it was before they were selected, right?
No.
It was not before the last
election.
The selection you're challenging occurred when?
The selection more challenging occurred on November 9th of 2009. At that point, they had only operated large aircraft for 2 months without the subsidy.
They had operated over 12 months, hadn't they?
On November 9th, 2009, no. They had only operated for 2 months. At that point, the Postal Service tendered bypass mail to Penair, and they received that subsidy for an entire year.
Wait a minute, Rob. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm a little confused.
The challenge you're actually select the selection you're actually challenging here occurred when?
The first, it, what happened was they sought tender mm-hmm. in August of 2009.
Yeah.
They were granted tender in November of 2009.
Right.
They were found to be exempt from the prior service and capacity requirement by the Postal Service.
Right, and that they carried for over 12 months after that, right?
They did. Well,
then the selection actually at issue here occurred after they carried, right?
I believe that we are...
2009 is a dead letter. There's already been litigation over that.
Okay, Your Honor, I think even if you take this December selection...
I don't think there's any even to it. I don't see any way that... That is not the one under challenge today.
The prior service and capacity requirement mandates that a carrier operate for 12 months without the bypass mail subsidy. They have never operated for 12
months.
If you look at it, it says...
Give me the statute
okay.
number.
The statute is can be found at Addendum 6 and 7. It's Section 5402 G1 A42.
Okay, read it.
It's
G1A42. Oh, it's 4 and subsection 2.
Subsection 2.
Scheduled service with at least the number of scheduled non-contract flights each week established in the paragraph referred between two points within the state of Alaska for at least 12 consecutive months with aircraft over 7,500 pounds. So at the time
before,
of the December...
But it goes on to say before being selected as a carrier
right,
of non...
The selection at issue here, they had carried for more than 12 months before the selection at issue here, right?
But they hadn't done it without the bypass mail subsidy. And if you look at the word before, it says you must do this before you are carrying and being compensated.
It says before being selected. You're the one who wrote a brief saying they put other words into the statute. And then I read your brief, and you were putting other words into the statute, and I asked you about them today, and you're putting still different words into the statute.
Your Honor, it says, before being selected as a carrier of non-priority bypass mail at an applicable intra-Alaska mainline service mail rate.
And what is the date of the selection we're talking about here?
The second selection was in December, but they
carried mail for 12 months before that, right?
Exactly. They carried the mail.
And they complied with the...
And they weren't allowed to carry the mail. You can't qualify to carry the mail while carrying the mail. It violates the plain language of the statute.
I haven't heard you quote that.
But I'm not sure how it violates the plain language of the statute.
It may violate the purpose. It may violate the intent. But the plain language argument... I just cannot follow a plain language argument that admits they've complied with every requirement in the plain language and then says, we win because they violated the plain language of the statute. That
the have provided counsel, in before makes it clear that you can't get the subsidy while you're seeking to qualify. It is in there that you can't carry the mail while you're qualifying.
You can't quote it to me. Chances, you still haven't quoted it to us, the part that says that.
It's the before being selected as a carrier at the intra-Alaska mainline.
That's what we just went over, and they've complied with all that.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Okay. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the government. Or whoever's next.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mitchell Zeff on behalf of the Postal Service. May it please the court, this case presents a Leadham versus Kind challenge to the Postal Service's decision.
Leadham versus Kind?
Yes. The appellants in this case, and they rely heavily on Aid Association for Lutherans, which cites heavily to Leadham versus Kind for the proposition that there's judicial review when an agency acts with no statutory authority whatsoever. This is not a challenge under the APA, and that makes sense.
Counsel, long before APA, you have the Chenery case, right? So what is it that that is not involved as a matter of principles of administrative law in this case?
I'm sorry, I'm...
What principles of administrative law do not apply to this case because the APA doesn't apply?
It's while you're thinking of that.
What difference does that make?
Leadham versus Kine was a case where an end run was needed around a statutory bar on review.
Right. It's got nothing to do with the price of tea. I don't understand why you're even raising Leadham and Kine, but I'm still trying to figure out why. Well, let me cut through here to get to the point. Where is the post office's interpretation of this convoluted statute?
I, first of all, appreciate that. You might think the statute is not a model of clarity, and we would argue that there's deference.
That's
deference to what? To the U.S. attorney's interpretation? The assistant U.S. attorney's interpretation? I do not see a post office interpretation of this statute. Can you show it to me?
I can point you first to the plain language.
No, counsel. Don't please make the plain language argument. That's enough to drive us crazy in this case.
Fair enough.
Because there's one thing that's perfectly clear about this case. It's not a plain language case, although all sides argue the plain language. But where is the post office's interpretation of this statute? Even in an informal adjudication, one would expect you would see an agency interpretation.
Yes. To answer your question, Your Honor, there's two interpretations, right, because there's two lawsuits in 2009 and 2010. Mm-hmm. So in 2009, the Postal Service's interpretation...
Show me where the interpretation...
...is essentially...
Well, no, essentially. Show me where the interpretation of the statute... post office interpretation.
It's the grant of...
No, they acted, but they didn't give you any interpretation, didn't give us any interpretation of the statute, did they?
What is it we're reviewing? What is it we're supposed to be deferring to? Well, we know the post office made a selection, but I'm not even sure after reviewing this case who in the post office made the decision, let alone what the basis was for the decision.
In 2009, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I think that's why I was... trying to say to both ears. In 2010, there's a long list of who made the decision, what it was based on.
2010, what would we look at to find how the post office came to this interpretation and who it was that did it?
You would look at the Joint Appendix 979, which is...
Read it to us. I want to...
It's the... declaration of Stephen Deaton, the Postal Service.
Yes, I didn't see an interpretation of the statute there. Am I mistaken? Is there an interpretation?
Yes, if you look at, I believe it's paragraph 4.
What does it say? Do you have it in front of you?
I do, if you give me one moment.
Honestly, I don't have it up here. I usually, whatever I don't bring is the part that I need.
So I'm reading from A979. It's the fourth paragraph, and I'm quoting, Your Honor. More specifically, the United States Postal Service confirmed that Pennair had satisfied the prior service and capacity requirement of 39 U.S.C. Section 5402 G1A4 by flying a mainline passenger aircraft between any two points within the state of Alaska for at least 12 months after reviewing the flight schedule submitted to the Postal Service, as well as data provided electronically to the Postal Service by the Official Airline Guide, which is an airline schedules database in which airlines are statutorily required to file their schedules. In reaching that conclusion, the Postal Service did not segregate bypass mail-carrying flights and non-bypass mail-carrying flights because the statute, Section 5402 G1A4, merely states that the airline requesting immediate equitable tender of mainline bypass mail must have, quote, provided scheduled service with at least the number of scheduled non-contract flights each week between two points within the state of Alaska for at least 12 consecutive months.
What is that document? I've confessed to not having it up here with me, so tell me what it is.
It's the declaration of Stephen Deaton, which was attached to the Postal Service's filings at the district
when
court.
When was that declaration made?
That was December 14th, 2010.
Now, you have no definition of new carrier, though, do you?
Now, that's the...
That was not at issue in the 2010 lawsuit.
Let's go back to the original part, assuming the whole case is in front of us now.
Okay. But
there's never any post office definition of new carrier. If, in fact, the Penn Air is right with respect to the fact that it's a new carrier, and two, it does not have to comply with the prior service requirement, then that's the end of the case. But we don't have any interpretation of the post office on those two issues, do we?
On those two issues, I'm just...
Assume that you get there on the second one, that is to say that the 12 months is covered by that declaration.
Okay.
Still, do you have anything that defines the new carrier, not on the part of the attorneys, not post hoc, but at the time that the decision was actually...
Other than just the tender letter that says...
Well, that never interpreted section 54025 A15, nor 5402 G5 C, did it?
All it did was grant tender for the reasons...
I know, but you don't have an interpretation of the statute.
All it said, basically, Your Honor, all the Postal Service did was say for the reasons stated in the letters before us, you got tender.
Well, you know what? This is a very confusing statute, and it's black letter administrative law that we would want an interpretation of the statute by the agency charged entrusted with the implementation. Now, one of the things that mystifies me is why the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't go back to the post office from the very beginning and say, give us an interpretation of this. Why are we fighting? This case has been fought through the district court and the court of appeals, and the one thing we lack is the basic ground work that you need in any administrative law case. And I'm wondering why the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't go back to the post office and say, hey, wait a minute, we need an interpretation of this statute.
I think the answer to that is, as convoluted as the statute is, with respect to the new issue, the plain language is actually much more clear, and I'm happy to walk you through why that is.
Yeah, go ahead and do that. Of course, if we don't have the administrative decision, then we have the duty of interpreting and applying statutes. But
absolutely.
So tell us why that is plain language.
So section 5402 G5C is what we're here about, Your Honor.
402 G5C.
Yes, that's okay. What the appellant's counsel referred to as the no incumbent provision.
You mean the notwithstanding subparagraph A thing?
Yes.
You're kidding. That's plain language? Notwithstanding subparagraph A, and then it ends on the requirements of subparagraphs A, C, and D. This is plain language?
What's plain language is the phrase new 121 mainline passenger carrier.
Which section are you reading from now?
I'm reading
5402 G5C.
Correct.
5402 G5.
It says, yes, Your Honor. It says.
This is the worst paragraph I've seen in 26 years of sitting on the bench.
I'm not going to argue with that.
His memory is not as good as it was.
But you still are going to argue that it's perfectly clear.
With respect to the phrase new 121 mainline passenger carrier, absolutely. Because that phrase, and as we argued in our briefs, section 5402 G5C obviously incorporates the definitional section, as any provision, any statute would. And new 121 mainline passenger carrier, right, that's a term of art, obviously, not something you hear on the street every day, but that has a plain meaning. It has the meaning that a mainline passenger carrier that began providing mainline bypass mail service after January 1st, 2001. That's what it means. And if you look at section A15, That's the definitional section for new. That's incorporated in the section 50.
That's the part that I think we're...
I'll try to help you out. Okay. If you look at A15, right, the lead-in clause, it says the term new when referencing a carrier. Okay, so we're talking
back to what Judge Silberman just referred you to. That, right? I mean, you were just explaining, right?
Right. So A15A tells you which carrier we're dealing with. We're dealing with either a carrier that meets the respective requirements of subclause 1 of section G1A4, which is bush carriers, because it applies to carriers with a payload capacity of up to 7,500 pounds, or subclause 2 of subsection G1A4, which is mainline carriers, carriers with a payload capacity of over 7,500 pounds. And here's the key language. Depending on the type of route being served and the size of aircraft being used to provide service. So section 5402 G5C is a mainline route with mainline carriers where no other mainline carrier is providing passenger service. That's actually a key distinction. You heard appellant's counsel say they're carrying mainline bypass mail on the routes at issue. That's true, but they don't provide any passenger service on the routes at issue. They're cargo-only carriers.
You put the word cargo in there, or freight. Well, I noticed that qualified in her answer.
Exactly, and G5C is dealing with mainline passenger carriers. So what we're dealing here is a route where the communities are receiving no passenger service whatsoever. And in those, so that is the type of route and the size of aircraft being used to provide service.
Assuming I don't, I'm still puzzled at why you didn't ask the post office for even an informal adjudication, an interpretation of the statute with respect to all the issues in this case.
I'm going to take why I didn't as sort of a general eye.
Yes, I mean, it's just, you know, I don't mean to be inappropriate about this, but I'm wondering if the Civil Division of the Justice Department had been handling this case with more sophistication, perhaps more sophistication about administrative law, they would have taken it right back to the post office and say, we need an interpretation of this statute.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because what the Postal Service had before it, this wasn't a request from a carrier saying, hey, I'm new, and the Postal Service says, okay, fine. They had a lot of documentation before it. They had the objections, by the way, to Penn Air's submission from Alaska Airlines. They're making the same argument that the
appellant. I know, but we don't have a clear interpretation of the statute on these relevant issues by the post office. We're faced with only the U.S. attorney's position on this.
We would obviously take a different position, but I'm not sure. That's a question that, is there a question I can answer? We take a different position.
You think you've got a clear interpretation of these various sections by the post office?
I wouldn't say that. I would
take the position. You would say, I think, if I put words in your mouth, that where there is not a deference-worthy interpretation, the court has to interpret the statute.
That's right,
the plain language. You would say this is the proper interpretation.
That's right.
Okay. Unless my colleagues have further questions, we've talked to you well past your time. Then we have an intervener to be heard, I think. So.
Okay.
Pardon?
No,
a second appellee. I said intervener, but I was referring inartfully to the second appellee.
Well, in that case, Your Honor, I would just ask that this court affirm the district court's orders in all respect, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Excuse me for calling you an intervener, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But while we're talking about your status, why did you cross appeal?
We noted a conditional cross appeal on the notwithstanding issue.
There was no need to cross appeal to raise the issue that you raised by the cross appeal, and it confuses the briefing considerably when you do it that way.
Since it was so clear and unconfused without that.
Well, I think we did need to. Here's why we noted a conditional cross appeal.
The issue raised in your cross appeal is that there is an alternative ground for arriving at exactly the same result.
Yes.
That does not require cross appeal.
You're right in most. The reason why there was a conditional cross appeal was the quirk in the way these cases were decided. Keep in mind, there was a first notice of appeal from that first district court decision. We did not appeal that decision. The cargo carriers, the plaintiffs, did. We noted a conditional cross appeal from that. That's why, as a matter of legacy, there was a conditional cross appeal. When the second appeal came about, it was still brought in time for this court to consolidate those appeals. So it's only a quirk of the way this court scheduled and consolidated those appeals. But our conditional cross appeal from that first case was certainly required if we were going to pursue that as a conditional claim.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if that carried over
the
whole thing together.
The alignment of this case and the briefing, of course, is emblematic of the way the statute itself is largely. But I think on closer inspection, both the briefing makes sense and I think the statute makes sense. And I'll begin with the new and explain why, admittedly, it doesn't provide any clear answers. But I do think, of course, part of Chevron Step 1 is more than just the words. It's the
how can we have,
we have to just do away with Chevron here and just interpret it the way we would if this were pre-Chevron?
I think ultimately the court's going to find itself in that position, but I will make a play for a plain meaning at least to this extent. I agree that the language, when you look at certain phrases in isolation, it may be unclear. But of course, part of the interpretive process is looking beyond that. And there are two structural components that I think underscore why a new mainline carrier must be one who carried mainline after January 2001. The statute divides the world into a binary existing and mainline. Existing is everyone who flew mainline non-priority bypass mail service before 01. New is the natural flip side. It's everyone who flew that particular mainline non-priority bypass mail. And if you look at the definition of existing mainline bypass mail carrier,
we determine what is.
Right. Well, at subsection A12, that defines existing mainline carrier, the flip side of what we're all talking about here, a new mainline carrier. That provision explicitly links it to the carriage of mainline non-priority bypass mail. If Congress thought the existing carrier was one who carried mainline bypass mail before 01, it makes sense to think that the flip side of that, the new, is one who carried mainline non-priority bypass mail after January 01. I think that makes sense when you look at those provisions in context. The reason why it's a little confusing in this definition of new in A15 is, for whatever reason, Congress decided to tackle both mainline and Bush in a single omnibus type of provision, thus the unadorned reference to non-priority bypass mail. But that's where context comes into play. The previous immediately subparagraph says, depending on the route served and the type of carrier. That is the strong signal.
Your argument is that the concept in A extends into B.
Exactly.
Well, that's hardly a plain language.
Well, I think when you look at the way Congress did that...
it's just hardly a plain language. It may be a reasonable interpretation. I don't know. But would you say if the post office came up with a opposite interpretation, that would be reasonable too?
I think that interpretation, unless it could harmonize it with the way Congress did that, I don't think it would be a reasonable interpretation. If the Postal Service were to say bypass mail means any bypass mail, I think that would read into it, as Your Honor indicated, any. And Congress did use the word all in other provisions of the statute when it signaled all bypass mail.
I'm inclined to think that would be a reasonable interpretation, too, that it could go either way.
Well, I think at the end of the day, if this court concludes that it's ambiguous and it has to decide for itself, I think on balance, the reasonableness of our interpretation, the district court's interpretation, the Postal Service interpretation makes sense. After all, what this ends up doing is freezing out in perpetuity a carrier from ever qualifying as a new mainline carrier. And I think there's one other textual component that at least underscores why the contrary interpretation wouldn't be reasonable, and that is, I think that interpretation would read out that subparagraph A provision altogether, because the upshot of their interpretation is that any carrier, so long
if
as...
If I was correct, for instance, that the post office could reasonably take the appellant's position here, right? If I was correct on that, and we were to interpret it as you would have us do, then the post office, under modern administrative law, could switch its position afterwards, couldn't it?
It could do that.
So that puts us in a somewhat awkward position, isn't it?
Well, I think that's a quirk of the way the record was assembled and the decision-making.
Yeah, so isn't there a Chenery problem if we were to try to, or if the district court affirmed, or we were to follow through and affirm? We're not supposed to do that on a rationale different than the agency did. So isn't there an inherent problem when we can't tell what the rationale of the agency was? I'm saying this not as a Chevron problem,
right,
but I think the worst thing happened to Chevron, it just shoves it over to us. But as far as the rationale for what they did, that's a Chenery problem.
That's right.
It would. I think if in this, in a case in which the agency was being asked to apply facts and apply its own rationale, I think that might be a problem. In this case, where it's a
Chenery,
pure question.
Chenery is not a question of facts. It's entirely a question of reasoning and really a statutory interpretation.
Right. And but it, again, before Chevron existed, when this court
Chenery
was called upon.
Predated Chevron.
It did. And
it predates the APA, too.
It, by 3 years, in fact.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
And the reason why that, as Judge Sintel said, it's up to the court traditionally to supply that interpretation if there's nothing for the agency or nothing for this court.
That's a statutory interpretation, but where it has that statutory interpretation underlies or provides a component of an agency's decision, and we can't tell what the agency was doing, how can we, in light of Chenery, affirm that decision that we can't tell what the rationale is?
Well, it's not a robust rationale, but what they certainly say at page 715 of the appendix in their letter, and it's a one-page letter, I grant you, is essentially for the reasons you spelled out in your application. Now, that's, I would say, similar to the way a court of appeals might say, for substantial the reasons the district court said, we think that it should be affirmed. I'm not saying that's a model of the way APA practice
Be. You know, we can't do that with respect to an agency. We can't say we'll affirm substantially for the reasons the agency said.
Right. You're limited, of course, under Chenery. But
we have to take out the adverb.
My argument isn't that this court can say for substantially the reasons the agency said. My argument is that the agency said for substantially the reasons affected that the petitioners articulated. Again, that's not a robust rationale. But to the extent you're saying
maybe
you're
the best you've got, man.
Well, and I think to the extent that the question is what is the agency's decision. There's no question what that decision is. What's the rationale? They essentially said, for the reasons you identified. I don't think that requires a remand to the agency, and if it did require any sort of remand to the agency, I think under Allied Signal, the court should not vacate the decision because of the disruptive effects it would have. And I think the court should simply take the issue, as Judge Sintel suggested, or if there's any question about what it might want to do, you can remand without vacating and let the process go forward and see what the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Postal Service may come up with. But I do want to get back to one point, final textual point. Their interpretation would render that subparagraph A provision completely superfluous, because their interpretation essentially is any carrier.
Which subparagraph
A? A15A.
You mean the first one or the second one?
The first one. The one that defines new. This is at addendum 2 of our statutory addendum.
And your position reads out the second one.
No, our position reads the second one in context. It doesn't read it out of. I don't think it reads it out at all. It says you have to supply some type of mainline service. I'm sorry, some type of non-priority bypass mail service. It just has to be mainline. That's our interpretation. Their view would basically, you can still achieve their view and strike A.
We couldn't remand this to Congress, could we?
I've often wanted to do that.
It would be a innovative separation of powers question, but it might well be worth it in this case.
I've
to invent
often wanted
it.
To.
But the point is that their interpretation does, I think, effectively read A out. There's nothing that A provides independently, because at the end of the day, their view is any bypass mail is tainted forever, and you can never qualify as new. Let me turn to the question of the 12-month list. As Judge Santel said,
we'll give you a minute to do it.
Oh, thank you very much. And I will just say the plain language on that, and I do think this one actually does have a plain language anchor. It says before being selected, and that's preceded by a clause that says in selecting. Those have to be read in tandem as referring to the same act of selection. As Your Honors recognize, the act of selection that's issue on this judgment is the one from December of 2010. It's undisputed that Pan Air flew for 13 months.
But you don't ever get to that issue if you win on the first issue.
No, if we win, if assuming the first issue is the new issue, we actually have to win on both issues.
Oh, you win. Well, there are three issues here. You don't get to the third issue if you win on the first two.
If we have to win on the new, and then we don't have to even get to that if you reach our cross appeal.
Right, exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
Exactly. And either one, we think the court should be affirmed below.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
We got you through your time, too. We'll give you, but given that I gave him a little more, we'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
You might address the question of whether, in the event of a remand, we should vacate or not. By Pan Air's counsel.
Your Honor, I do believe that if there is a remand, it should be vacated because the agency hasn't provided any analysis, as the district court found, supporting its decision.
But Allied Signal talks about a balance of hardships and also an assessment of probabilities of what the outcome will be. And it's not clear in my mind that that test points very clearly in either direction.
Well, the balance of hardships, we've already seen that Pan Air unlawfully carried bypass mail for 10 months, and so my clients already have suffered.
From the Postal Service's viewpoint, that's a point in its favor. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a point in its favor because it interpreted the statute incorrectly, according to the district court, and for 10 months.
Suppose we disagreed with the district court or are inclined to disagree with the district court.
On the issue of the notwithstanding? I think still, though, the fact is...
Well, let me put it this way. Suppose we concluded the statute was pretty ambiguous on various issues, but that the post office could reasonably interpret it to support Pan Air. Should we then vacate?
Yes, I think that would be appropriate, Your Honor, because we don't know exactly what the Postal Service did to reach its conclusion, and it would be supplanting.
That's the basis of
that gets us to the remand. It gets us to the remand. That doesn't address the vacature.
But it would be, in that situation, it would be appropriate to put it back to the status quo of when Pan Air sought the application. Instead, they sought the application and they immediately began to receive tender of mainline bypass mail, even though they had never operated for 12 consecutive months.
But they have now.
They have now. And if I could get back to that point and try this once again, there is one place where the Postal Service actually has a robust interpretation of the statute, and that's at the appendix at 1178. In 2001, the Postal Service was asked to interpret the prior service and capacity requirements.
Was that the same statute?
Yes, it's the same language. It was before...
A different statute, right? It's a different iteration of the statute.
It's a different iteration, but it's the exact same language that's in front of the court today. That language did not change at all. And they interpreted the... And they did a plain language interpretation, and they said that the Postal Service had concluded... They concluded that the prior service and capacity requirement, quote, must be enforced as a prerequisite to eligibility to carry non-priority bypass mail.
Suppose we thought that that was ambiguous and they could switch their position.
I think it goes to whether it was reasonable for them to switch their position.
Oh, well, that would depend on how they articulated their reasoning.
Instead, all they said is that this interpretation doesn't matter because it was prior to the RISHA, but it's the exact same language.
I would never suggest the post office is covered with glory here.
But I think the point is, for this requirement to mean anything, you have to demonstrate your financial and operational capability without the bypass mail subsidy. Otherwise, if you could carry the mail while you're qualifying to carry the mail...
Roots of the poisonous tree. That's your argument. Is that correct?
Well, it is somewhat, but also that the fact is that no one is, Panair's asking for an exemption. They admit that no other carrier is going to be able to come in and say, I'd like to carry the mail while I'm seeking to satisfy the prior service.
That's a totally different question as to whether you could prospectively allow somebody to do this and whether retrospectively we simply apply the plain words of the statute.
I guess
not the same question.
I disagree with Your Honor that applying the plain language of the statute gets you to any different position than
they
the reasonable.
We went through that. We looked at the language and we looked at the facts, and you were not able to come up with anything that took the language, the facts outside the language,
well,
except by writing in more adverbs.
I guess
you do it with one adverb, but you have to write in at least one.
But I go back to the point that it prohibits the carriage of mail prior to satisfying the requisite service.
No, it allows the carriage of mail after satisfying the requisite service. And they have satisfied the requisite service.
But they didn't do it without carrying the mail.
You say it shouldn't count, but you can't get out of the fact that they have provided the requisite service.
With the subsidy. And
they provided the requisite service, right or wrong?
They did provide it with the subsidy.
With the subsidy, so you're going to use a propositional phrase rather than just one adverb, but you're still changing it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.